If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast, and it's another special. Today's guest is none other than Jason Fox, ex-SAS. You might know him from the Channel 4 TV show SAS, Who Dares Wins. He's written a book called Battle Scars, so I thought I'd get him on. And it's a fascinating thing, because before I'd even read the book, I mentioned this to him at the top of the interview, actually. I'd written a load of questions that I wanted to know. I wanted to know more about the mental side of war and what it's like to be a soldier rather than the sort of Rambo-esque stories. And he answers them all in the book. It's such a great read. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Really enjoyed having him on the podcast. There is so much to talk to him about that, we would have had to, we'd have to spend 3 hours covering his whole life story. Really good stories and great insight into, hopefully it comes across in the podcast. Do you think it does?
Yeah, he's fascinating. And it's very difficult, I think, for him, because there's certain things he can't say. So you can see him, every time you ask him a question, his answer is, he's having to go, right, what can I say here? Do you know what I mean? I think he's very interesting, but he has to hold something back, I think, doesn't
because
he?
Because of the MOD.
Yes, yeah.
Also, you can't...
But that makes it really interesting, I think.
Yeah, and also you can't be too flippant about war.
No.
And especially in today's climate, which we're maybe quite rightly sensitive of what's going on everywhere. And it's like, you know, so you've got to be very careful with what you say.
It's because war is the absolute last answer to any question, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, sadly, it doesn't seem to be that way, Mark.
Well, I know what you mean.
Topical.
But do you know what I mean? It's such a serious thing. It's the absolute last resort. Mm. And it's a last resort because it's so horrible. It looks so horrible.
Well, I hope it comes across in the podcast, but he deals with all these things in the book. He talks about them all. And I'm trying to talk a lot about the book without giving too much away, because it is a really good read. And as you go through it, it's a real page turner, as they say, because you start reading it, you go, I can't put this down now. What happens? So it's an interesting journey into his life and how he deals with PTSD and all those sort of things. Okay, let's meet him then. This is Jason Fox.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Love Joy.
Jason, thank you for coming today. Welcome to my kitchen. I bought you a present, like everybody. This red wine.
I'm a massive red wine fan.
Oh, are you? Oh, yeah. Good. Oh, good.
That's
okay.
Awesome.
Excellent. I was wondering whether you're drunk or not. How does drinking work when you're in the army? When you're actually out in the actual war zone, do you ever get your hands on alcohol at all out there?
Officially, no. We had meat. There is means and ways of doing it, but yeah, officially, it is quite dry when you're away on those trips. It's like a health farm with a bit of a stressful underlying tone to it. But you don't normally drink. On the odd occasion that we're not working, which is very odd, we now manage to get hold of a little bit of booze.
So when you come home and you have time off, heavy drinking?
Yeah, it's quite the military. It was. It's not so much now, but the military was, especially when I first joined, is a very, it's a bit too boozy. There's a big drinking culture. So yeah, you'd come back.
But I suppose all those jobs with stress were or are like the force, the police forces, and all
it's
that
just,
sort of thing.
I suppose it's a vent, isn't it? It is a sort of a vent. Yeah. It's not a great one, but I mean, you'd be away, so like you'd go away for 6 months and you'd come back. Obviously, you're military guys. You come back and you generally think you're like a pop star, because you're like, I haven't spent money for 6 months. What am I going to do with this? And so, what do? You go and buy a load of that and get smashed up.
You're here talking about your book, which I just said to you, actually, it's really interesting because I picked it up and I thought it's going to be a normal SAS book. You know, look at me, I've taken on 100 people and killed them all single-handedly and I've been tortured and everything else. I love those books, by the way. There's nothing against them. But I'd written a whole load of questions all about the mental side of war and being in the SAS. And you've answered so many in the book. I've got to say, brilliant read. Loved it.
Thank you.
Haven't put it down. Response to the book been good?
So far, yeah. I mean, yeah, so far, so good. Today was the release, so we'll wait and see, but it's been okay.
Different way of looking at it, though. You open yourself up a lot in this book.
I mean, it's been 2 years. It's taken us 2 years, and when I didn't know whether I wanted to write a book, and a friend of mine, Matt, who's actually the writer, he said, you know, I think it would be a good thing for you to do. And I said, right, okay, maybe. But I don't want it to be a war story where we talk about all heroic, glorified things to do with war. I wanted it to be my emotional journey and then my sort of, not struggle, but just my journey with mental health, you know, PTSD, yeah. Depression, what they called chronic burnout. And yeah, we've managed to do it.
Yeah, but you also managed to make me feel very anxious, which is good.
It's
that great thing of when you're I like the format of it because it's your thought process. It keeps on coming in between the story, what you're actually thinking about, and I'm feeling anxious for you, and I think that's a great thing. I think you managed to capture war well, mm-hmm. or combat battle, I'm not sure which way to describe it, but when you're about to go and do something and you're going, and you're sort of saying, I'm scared now, or I'm not comfortable with this. It's like, you say, oh my God, you're about to go and do something where you could potentially die. And, you know, because we always have the assumption that you guys just don't care, you're immune to it all.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to get across, is the fact that it's just, we are, you know, the people that still do that job now, we've got friends that are still in it, me, other people that have left now, they're just normal blokes that just end up doing that job. You've got to have something, I don't know what, well, I sort of hazard a guess at what to do the job, but again, you're just still a normal bloke that does some crazy stuff every now and again.
6 years since you've been in?
Yeah.
Miss it?
No, not now. I did. I feel like I did 20 years and I obviously medically discharged for PTSD and that was probably 2 or 3 years short of my career finishing. So I sort of felt a bit shortchanged at the beginning, and I missed it. And when I now look at it, it's not so much the job itself, which was cool, but it is more the identity that goes with it, the belonging. It's not dissimilar to, you know, any other job, really. If you've done it for a long time and loved it and it's a career, once you do come out of the back end of it and finish it, you miss bits of it, and it's normally the camaraderie.
Yeah, you make the comparison with footballers.
Yeah, I would suggest it's pretty much the same.
Yeah, dressing room. Yeah, I did soccer around for years, so I met lots of ex-footballers, and they can never replace that bit where they get up and they meet up with all their mates every day, and they play football, and when they're on that pitch for 90 minutes, they're desperately trying to get a result, and they're training during the week. They can't replace it. They really struggle.
But it is almost, apart from the dynamic of the two jobs, it is very similar, because they're also putting themselves under a lot of stress when they're doing that job, because they have to perform, don't they? And that in itself is a stress, and it's the same with the job I did.
I think yours is harder, if I'm honest with you.
Well, the 150 grand a week could have, you know, that would have been all right.
Yeah, and they're in nightclubs and some of those vulgar cars and stuff, you know. Like, you know, I think I'd rather do their job than yours. Right, what age did you get in?
Why?
Well, not what age?
Well, I joined the Marines at 16. And there was two reasons. Firstly, I grew up in Luton, and somehow I knew I needed to get out of there because I was going to go down the wrong path. And secondly, my dad was in the Marines years and years and years ago, but it influenced me to a certain degree.
What do you mean the wrong path? What that led to?
I didn't grow up in a great. It wasn't in a great place. I was probably easily led. Right. I didn't do very well at school. In fact, I didn't do very well. I was shocking, and I was more of an outdoorsy person, bit of sport, I like that. So I figured, right, I'll join the military, join the Marines.
What age did you get in the SAS then?
25. So I did about 9 years. Then what happened was I enjoyed being I enjoyed being a soldier. I just didn't enjoy a lot of the bullshit that went with it. Right. So there's a lot of the pomp and ceremony. I'm not good at like getting dressed up for parades, walking through London, and I look a bag of. You know, I don't look good. I can never dress up smart in that stuff, and I didn't really like it. I didn't like the sort of the admin that went with it. But I did enjoy being a soldier. I liked rolling around in the dirt and just being a kid, really. So I figured if I was going to do it, continue doing it, then what should I do? Right, okay, join the Special Forces.
So 25 you get in. Mm-hmm. Is that when you actually officially become SAS, or do you then train for how long?
No, you put in to do selection, start. There's 350 of us started. And then if you get to the end, which is about 9 months later, 6 months to 9 months later, that's you. You finish and you join this squadron. I think there was 10 of us that finished ours.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a bit mad. Yeah.
What does it take to become good SAS?
It's an amalgamation of a few things. You need to be stubborn. You need to have a little bit of... You've got to be physically robust. Psychologically robust with regard to how you deal with certain things. I say that now, having suffered from PTSD. You need to have a flexible mindset, be able to, you know, roll with the punches, so to speak. So if something doesn't go to plan, don't freak out about it. And then you've got to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations.
So, one of my favourite bits of your book, by the way, was when you're out at the end and you start talking about working in normal environment. I've had Megan Hine on. Do you know Megan Hine? She does all the survival stuff on TV shows. A bit like you sort of did for a while and stuff like that. And so, you know, she's a good sort of survival expert and stuff. And she changed my life a bit. Actually, your book's very like this, because you start thinking about actually what it takes to survive rather than in our fake world we live in.
Yeah.
And when you actually arrive in proper job, as in our sort of jobs, and you start talking about they're lying and they're not sticking to the rules, and they're not, and it's all the things that if you do that in the army, you're going to die.
Yeah.
Especially in your life. And you're like going, they're not sticking to the, you know, they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. And it frustrates the hell out of you. This is what most of our society is.
That was one of the hardest things to come to terms with, having been in the military, because you're told all the time, like, as an example, if I was doing a surveillance task in the military and you get asked what's happened, you're like that. You tell them exactly what's happened, whereas I left and people just speculate. And I'm like, you can't speculate. You don't know whether that's actually happened.
Yeah.
Just tell it how it is. But we're creative people. People are creative, aren't they? They're like making stuff up and...
Lying.
Yeah, basically lying.
You can't
it was
really,
a nice way I'm of saying
sure,
they're liars.
I'm sure in the army there's plenty of liars, but when you get to the Special Forces, if you're lying, you could kill all your mates, couldn't you, basically, I suppose. Yeah. You got to trust each other, haven't you, when it gets to that?
Exactly, yeah. And it was, I mean, again, that's something else that's really difficult is, I mean, a squadron of guys, 25, 30 guys, we work together all the time. It's the same guys, it's the same people. And you sort of, we're not all best mates. It's far from it, you know. We've got a handful of mates that are my best mates, but it's not that. It's the fact that the nice thing is he might not be your best mate. I might not want to go on the piss with him or drink beer with him, but I know that when it hits the fan, I can count on him to be there for me, whether he's behind me, in front of me, or left or right.
Do you remember your first battle combat? Was it in the SAS or was it before?
No, it was in. I spent 9-10 years in the Marines, basically traveling the world, having a great time, drinking a lot, having a laugh, playing sport. And then obviously, you know, I joined just after 9/11 and the world changed a little bit. And so it was in the SAS. Yeah, I can remember it, yeah.
What was it like, though? What was the feeling when you knew you were about to go into battle?
It's funny because you sort of like, there had been a lot of occasions prior to that where it was sketchy. We'd been, you know, going into dodgy areas, but nothing really happened. So there was, the edge was always there. And then sort of when it happened, it was like the adrenaline was like unbelievable. It was like a proper high. Then there was a bit of fear going on, because actually when it did happen, the bloke either side of me got shot. It was just, I don't know, just by chance I didn't. And then you're like, ah, brilliant, I've done it. I've been in a firefight. I've done what I've actually, like, I've spent 10 odd years in the military training for this moment, and it's happened. Mm. So there was a bit of elation. And then when it all dies down and you get back to your base and you get into bed, there's like a massive come down. You're a bit like, what was that all about? Okay, I need to do it again. So it's like, there's a little, it can become, it's the adrenaline that's addictive, not the situation itself. It would be mental to be addicted to that situation. It's the adrenaline.
Does your reality change? That, by the way, if you're reading the book, when you read the book, there's lots of explanations of what it's like to go into these extreme situations of conflict. It's quite a hard read. It's digest. Made me quite anxious. But does your reality change? Do you have a? I mean, obviously, we'll talk about the PTSD in a bit, but your reality when you're seeing stuff and you're in a war zone. Does it feel different?
Yeah, it does. One of the main reasons it does is because of the job I did. Most of the time we worked at night and you have night vision goggles on, and it basically douses the entire world in like a weird surreal green. If you ever watch war films or you see these computer games that people play.
Yeah.
They mimic the night vision look, and it just looks like you're looking at something through a computer screen. It's very grainy. Everything's got a green tint to it. So it does it. It probably helps with the detachment a bit of the mentalness of war.
Does things slow down when you're actually face to face with it?
They do. It's funny. I don't know whether I describe it now. I've described it before where I remember sitting on the back of a helicopter and you can see there was gunfire. So,
yeah, you do. Yeah. You think you're going to dodge a bullet.
Yeah, you can see it coming and you're like, that's going really slow. And then it just goes, and you're like, oh, yeah, maybe actually this is quite serious.
Yeah, your senses must just come alive.
Yeah, yeah.
Because apparently we go through most of the day not using our senses much. But when you get into a situation like that, surely they become heightened.
I think definitely. Yeah. Smells? It's hard. Smell, you. Yeah, I can... I miss some of the smells. I miss the pungent, sweaty, earthy smell of coming down from 10,000 feet in a helicopter down onto the ground. It's like a natural indicator. You're like, oh, hang on a minute, we're about to do something for real now. So obviously the smells pick you up, remind you of stuff as well. And then obviously you can see stuff and you think you can dodge it, and you can't.
One of the other things you make a point in your book is afterwards you start trying to go to the gym and stuff after you've left for a while and you're struggling with motivation. Doesn't look like you're struggling now, by the way.
I'm struggling this morning. Yeah.
Is that the motivation when you're in special forces? You're thinking, I need to be fit here, because when we get called into action, I've got to stay alive.
Yeah, it is. It's sort of like it's bred into you. I mean, I become institutionalized, but it's still there. I need to do it. It's actually good for me mentally as well. You know, it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
It releases these endorphins and what have you.
Why are we so good, our forces? Are we still one of the best in the world?
100%, yeah. And that's not, I wouldn't say, I'd be honest with you, if there was, you know, there are other countries that have really good forces, but we are head and shoulders in our mentality and mindset, I'd say we're a lot better. And I think it's down to, firstly, the British sort of mentality.
Right.
We are quite stubborn. We're always the underdog, which makes us want to do better and prove ourselves. And also, we live in this country, which is horrific weather. It makes you hard when you're out and about in this stuff. It is. Yeah, You know, the British Army and our military train in Wales.
Yeah.
You can't help but be hard.
But what's it like when you're in the heat, though? Do you become accustomed to it quite quickly?
You sort of do. I prefer the cold.
Right.
The heat, I get a little bit narky. I can remember sitting on a plane, on a Hercules plane, you know, the transport planes. We were in the middle of the desert, and there was literally... there weren't enough seats. Everyone was lying everywhere. I had legs over me. I had like arms over me. I was getting like super angry. And I thought someone had poured a bottle of water down my neck, and they hadn't. It was just, I was sweating that much. It was just pouring down me, which made me even angrier.
There's obviously times in the book where you talk about casualties on our side. Mm-hmm. That must be quite a hard thing to deal with.
You don't think about it at the time. you sort of just get, it's again, everything's green haze normally, and you sort of just have to deal with it. So you're always thinking about what it is that you actually need to do, whether it's still the mission is whether you still have to achieve the mission because you haven't finished the job, or you're trying to get out of an area because you've finished, you know, you've achieved your aim and you want to get out of there. So it's afterwards when you sort of take stock of what's happened that it can become a little bit difficult, because obviously they're your mates, they're blokes that you work with.
How hard is it to then not want... I'm trying to word all these questions without trying to stitch you up, basically.
No.
To not want revenge. It must be really hard not want to go, all right,
do you know what? Again, that emotion doesn't come into it, because once you start doing that, you'll lose control of yourself.
Right,
you'll lose focus, which you'll become like a headless chicken. Mm. You know what I mean? So it's like if you allow fear to set in properly, it can become contagious and it can become negative, where actually fear, if you control the emotion, is something that focuses you. Like for me, I'm scared of heights. So when I start doing stuff at height, I'm like, whoa. But then I'm like, right, just concentrate on what I need to do. Am I doing the right thing? And it's the same with like the anger. It's like, well, there's no point.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? We need to get a job done.
This is my stupid question, really, but do you sometimes think I'm lucky to be alive? Because
yeah,
quite a lot
I think
of
so.
Death
yeah.
been around you, hasn't
when
there?
I think about it, when someone says, oh yeah, if you come close to dying, I'm like, I think I've come pretty close. Yeah.
Yeah, reading your book, you have. And what's it like then when you come home? And I'll tell you a story. My friend was in the Marines. He said what he really struggled with, and he learned very quickly just to shut up. He'd be sitting at dinner tables. He got discharged. He was injured, basically.
Yeah.
And he had to shut up really quickly because people all got their opinion on war, but have never actually been there. And he said, there's just no point in talking about it in the end. Mm. But he said there's a lot of people at the time calling people baby killers and stuff like that. And he really struggled with it. So he said, just keep your mouth shut. Don't tell anyone you're in the Marines. And so going... protecting your country and all that, when there's an anti side of it, how hard is that for people like you?
I don't find it that hard now. I suppose I did a little bit, and again I probably did the same. I mean, I say I'd shut up, I've written a bloody book, but it's a bit too hard now, but in the beginning, yes, and now I just, you know, if there's a bit of a debate, I'll listen, and then I'll explain to people that, you know, I did what I did because I believed in what I was doing at that time. I had to sell it to myself. I had to sell it. If you were going to do a job well, you've got to believe in it, haven't you? So, you know, the reasons we were out there at a point in time, it was what I wanted to do.
Is it a case in war that we have laws and rules and the oppo don't? Or does that make us a better force because we do have that?
I think it makes us morally, we're better because of that, because of those rules and regulations that we put in place. Moralistically, it's better for us. I don't know how those people deal with, you know, justifying what they do. On, you know, some people, I get it, it's a self-defense thing, but, you know, what goes on in the world now is pretty horrific.
I think I know the answer to this because I think I've read the answer in your book, but can you be political when you're in the army?
No, you can't. Because, you know, parties change and you'll remain in that job. So you're just there to do a job. You're there for the lads, really. You're there for the people either side of you. Yes, there's an element of patriotism. I am patriotic. You know, I'm proud to be British. But you can't start thinking about politics. You just can't.
You just have to switch off totally from it, do you?
Completely,
So whatever war, whatever happens, you just go, right, this is my job. This is what I'm doing. I'm going to go there. And
obviously, if you weren't going to buy into it, like I'm a big, you know, I sort of go by the live by the sword, die by the sword type thing.
Yeah.
So if you don't have that attitude, then you're probably not in the right job.
Yeah.
Could I do that job now? I probably would do, yeah.
You know what, it's interesting. Another point in it is you sort of, because we always think the British Army, we're the best, we're great. You know, you just pointed out we are. But the opposition aren't,
they're not stupid.
You say they're learning quickly as well. When you keep landing in the same place, they soon learn you're there. And then it's,
you look, I mean, we've got God knows how much money at our disposal. Well, we haven't got that much now, but you know, research and development, the kit we've got is awesome. And they still put up a good fight, and they ain't got much. So
they've got passion.
They've got passion
for what they believe in. Yeah,
and yeah, there's a lot of other things that go in line with why they'd fight what they see as an invading force.
So, someone told me recently, I don't know how true you think this is, that special forces are becoming more important because wars will be fought with three things, apparently: drones, which obviously is huge now, yeah. And you know, you must see them out there all the time. Mm-hmm. Cyber warfare,
yeah,
and special forces are how wars are going to be fought. There's not going to be as many boots on the ground. Do you think it's moving that way?
I think so. I think a lot of it's down to cost. You know, a conventional force is extremely, extremely expensive, and I don't know whether they have massive purpose, but I don't know whether they're employed properly sometimes. Whereas having a smaller group of people, so as an example, like a squadron of guys in the special forces, which is essentially about 30 guys, give or take, that is actually, it's a strategic asset. It has strategic impact and actually costs less than an entire battalion of people. Right. And it has, because it delivers at a strategic level, you know, it's commanded by ministers and top brass. It has, for the cost, it delivers more impact.
In your time in the forces, did you see the impact drones were having?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. They give you a massive advantage because they're feeding all this information into you.
And also, I suppose they can protect you as well, can they? Can especially you guys, they know where you're going in, and you can say, we're coming out, bomb it or whatever.
Yeah, they can. They can drop ordnance, bombs and whatnot. They sometimes... We used to use them quite a bit, and we would get information off them because it's obviously got a downlink where you can see what that's looking at. So right. You sort of like, you get intelligence from it, and when they work properly. I mean, I've seen one where a mountain keeps getting closer and closer, and you're like, what's going on with that drone? And then it just, and then the snow appears, and you're like, oh, it's crashed.
I suppose you can't tell me too much but what sort of things do the SAS do, or is that something you don't want to touch on really? You talk about your missions a bit, but
you do, like, they're employed in all sorts of things. You know, a lot of it is you do what people call door kicking, which is raids,
yeah,
surveillance. You know, you'll get involved in sort of counter-terrorism, counter-narcotics. They're involved in all sorts of stuff everywhere.
I had a guy on Sunday brunch come on and talk about the special forces. The first ever special forces, the SAS, was set up. There were a bunch of psychos who joined in who basically quite like going around. They weren't having enough fun in the war, so they just wanted to go across to enemy lines, and that's how that was sort of set up. So that was the reputation.
The roguish,
so, yeah. It's, I can't imagine you can have psychos in it now, or does it appeal to them?
You don't know that, like, a proper psycho probably would be seen and maybe pushed to one side. But you want an element of, you want someone who's got a sort of tendency to be a little bit, you know, roguish in his attitude. It's encouraged that you think outside the box a little bit, and you know, you think of other ways to do things that aren't quite the norm, but not, I don't think you're encouraged to be a psychopath. That would be pretty, pretty bad for everyone involved, really.
Let's talk about the PTSD then, because it's great the way you've addressed it in the book, I must say. I was quite shocked right at the beginning when you started saying I was sort of thinking about my mum and stuff when I in war.
I was shocked.
Yeah, but in war, and you're going, wow, that's not what I'm expecting, you know, from a book like this. And then, you know, it's great. I couldn't put it down then, because you started talking about the mental side of things. Let's talk about what it's like, first of all, mentally on the front line out there doing what you're doing. You start talking about missing home. You were going through a divorce, weren't you? And also, the bit that I was fascinated about, and I'd sort of written this prior to reading the book, which is, we all think you haven't got any feelings when you're out there, yet you must be thinking about what's going on back home. Mm. When you're out for long periods of time, which you are, your girlfriends, your wives, you must start worrying what's going on with them. Mm. And also, you actually mentioned in your book, whether they might be playing away. This stuff is going through your head just before you're about to go into battle in one of the stories.
The worst thing that happened to the army is bloody social media and the new age of technology, because the first few times I'd gone away, excuse me, it wasn't really there. And we used to moan about that. Why in this day and age can we not contact home? And then when you can, you're like, ah, oh, I wish we could go back to the time when we didn't have a phone, you know, didn't have the internet.
Yeah.
Because everything was just, you were a bit more detached, to be honest, and you could concentrate more on the job at hand. Whereas once, you know, once everything came in, you'd have things like, your mate would phone his missus after 2 days, and then when you eventually phone your missus, she's like, how come such and such?
Oh,
and
you're God, like, yeah.
Oh, mate, you've just proper stitched me. You know, that sort of thing. But then also you're sort of like getting involved in, you know, the washing machine breaks down, money's run out. You're like, ah, I've got bigger fish to fry, to be honest. It's
like, I'm laughing, so, yeah. But it's,
you know, it's true. It's like, you know, I remember we'd sit down and like all of us would be chatting about someone's, you know, I'm sure she's seeing someone from around, you know, and then, or vice versa, or
all that stuff plays on your mind though.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, because I think that happens a lot with things like cricket. Those guys go on tour forever. And then they start, you know, and everybody starts, both sides go, wonder what they're doing on tour and wonder what they're doing at home.
Exactly.
Because there's a lot of depression in cricket. I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah.
And I think it's because they're away from home a lot. And and it's tough when you're away because all that stuff's placed in your mind. But you're in life-threatening situations. And as you put in your book, you're running through this sort of
month. I can remember the bit that you're on about as well. Because I can remember just literally having a proper Barney on the phone. And the only reason I had the opportunity to do that was one of the helicopters had broken down. So they were like, look, we probably take a couple of hours to fix it. And I sort of walked, we went off to get some food, and I walked past this, like, the welfare building, like, shack. And I thought, oh, I'll just check my emails. Worst thing I ever did, ended up having a massive Barney with my missus. She'd left me, and oh, gosh, she was then admitted that she was with someone else. And I remember getting back on the helicopter being like, trying to fucking concentrate on one thing, and then in the end I was just kept thinking about her.
Yeah.
And sat down at home with some dude, and I'm like, ugh. So yeah, it was weird, but anyway.
A strange place to be, isn't it? When all that stuff's going through. So are you able then to go professional and just switch back into mode eventually?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Once someone starts shooting at you, it's sort of like all of a sudden you suddenly realise there's the bigger fish that's supposed to be fried.
Yeah, there it is, yeah. Right there. The bullets are flying in. So all right. So tell us about when the PTSD, when you first started. You talk about a lot in the book. When you first started feeling it, you're quite in denial, weren't you?
I was, and it was quite difficult to work out what was going on, because it was, people are like, oh, you know, some people say to me, were you jumping under cars, and did you realize, because you kept going back to places? And I was like, no, I didn't. It was just, I'd come back from being away, I felt a little bit detached, admittedly, but I came back from being away, had a few weird moments, but then I was getting ready to go away again. It was like another tour was coming up, and I'm a seasoned vet apparently, and I should be someone that inspires younger lads in the squadron, what have you. But this tour that was looming in the distance, it was like 4 months away, just looked like a black cloud, and I wasn't looking forward to it. And I'd always looked forward to it. And so it was weird. It was a weird feeling that I wasn't comfortable with. And all I wanted to do was get rid of that being a black cloud and it to be something that I was looking forward to. And it didn't, it wasn't really to be the case. But at first I was just like, why do I feel like this? And you know, it's not that I'm not good at my job or I've hurt myself or anything like that. I'm just not looking forward to it. I liken it to, I felt like I'd lost my military mojo and I wanted to get it back because I loved that job. I didn't know why I wasn't enjoying it.
And how did it... So I don't want to ruin the whole story for people, because I really think it's a really good read and I think people should do it, but it starts driving you mad, really, doesn't it, in the end? And you decide you're going to come out of the military. Yeah. How are you feeling now?
Now?
Yeah.
Yeah, really good.
You're feeling good now?
Yeah, I've had a bottle of red wine. It's amazing.
Well, you've had quite an exciting adventure in the last few years, you know.
Yeah, so, no, it's been good. It's been, I've had to work out what it is that I need to do to make me okay, which is actually, when I look back at it, I'm like, oh, it was so easy. Why didn't I just do that in the first place? But
which is
there was just a few things, being honest with myself about who I am and what I am and what makes me tick.
Well, you've done that in this book.
And then I give myself the opportunity to be more childlike.
Okay.
So more live in the moment as opposed to the past and stop worrying about the future so much.
The thing which intrigued me a lot in it, though, was when they start putting you on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. And I just did it for a little while, and I'm a bit how you describe it. It was great. Not great, but it was, because that's how I felt my life was being numbed away from me.
Yeah.
And I hated it. I just came off mine cold turkey, which was an incredible week afterwards. I've got to tell you, but when I was on them, I was like, this is not me. I just feel weird. And I don't know.
I felt terrible. I've had a few. I got given a few. And the first thought, I can't really remember feeling anything. I can remember reading the side effects and being like, scared about taking these. But then I got given another one, and I can remember we went away for a family visit, and I dropped this pill, and then for 3 days I could not hold I couldn't string a sentence together.
That's like me.
I felt smashed.
I had to do TV and I was slurring, seriously. And I read that, anyone remembers any of those shows back then when I slurred? I went online. The doctor who gave them to me said, don't Google it, because there's all the sorts of weird things on there, they'll tell you. And I Googled it, and it said, hair loss of short-term memory, slurred speech. I thought, I'm a TV presenter. It's kind of all the things I need are these. And it's like, you know. Mark said, no one noticed, yeah. Yeah, don't laugh at that. It's not funny.
You're in control of all the devices.
So it's a weird time when you're a man who's in control of everything suddenly loses a bit of control like that.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with them helping. I think it just masks something that it's not getting resolved.
Yeah, it does help some people who have chemical imbalances. For people like me, I'm not interested in it. But for some people, I suppose it's one of those things. Right, so you're feeling good now. Do you think it was a tough thing for you to admit, especially in the book and to all the brotherhood, as you call it, all your colleagues in the army, that you had PTSD? Is it still thought of as a failure?
In me?
In you or everybody?
No, I did.
Not you, I know, because you've done it in the book.
Yeah. No, I don't think so, not at all. If anything, it's, I'm glad that I was a bad example of, you know, they try to encourage people to come forward and talk about it, and then I lose my job, which in itself people would have been like, well, I'm not going to talk about it because I'll end up with no job, without a job that I loved. And
yeah.
So there is a point that I am a bad example, but also hopefully a good one, because things have changed in the organisation, and actually I've got friends who have had wobbles, addressed them openly, honestly, and then been, you know, gone back into work, and they're still doing that job.
Yeah.
So it's not seen as a failure now. It's just seen as part of my life by myself and them, and I think it's also a part of the process now. You know, it's helped an organisation, not me personally, but you know, a number of cases, and you know, the organisation that, you know, the government or the military, whatever you want to call them, have sort of learnt from, you know, past cases and are now better equipped to deal with them.
It's funny in the book, because you're one minute you're being sort of Rambo-esque, as it were, and then the next minute you're really sensitive. It's a strange.
Yeah.
You wouldn't expect anyone who's put in the position of you would be as sensitive as you come across in the book.
Mm. I think my past partners might disagree. Yeah, it's like a bit of a look. I am actually sensitive. I suppose it's just, again, it just comes down to me wanting to be honest about what I experienced emotionally, really.
Okay, so you spend 2 years writing this book. Were you worried about some of the things you were saying there in the book then?
Yeah, a little bit. The worst bit was when I was reading it for the audio, and I was like, oh, that's quite...
That's not very Rambo.
I mean, there's a few funny stories in there. Names and identities have been changed to protect the guilty. But, yeah. There's a few of those funny stories actually where I was a bit like, oh, the blokes that know, they know.
All right. Because yeah. You've changed locations and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. There's no real mention of anything like that. All the stuff that, you know, the MOD would be bothered about is actually the stuff that's pretty boring, to be honest.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned.
What do they think about you writing a book? What do they think of all you guys who write books about it? Are they
they're not keen. I'll definitely say that. They're not very keen about it. And they... sort of, they would advise against it, but they know that they can't really, they can stop it, but they know that these things are going to come out. So obviously I wrote that, then I had to give the manuscript to the MOD,
right,
to the SF world as well, and they look through it, read it, and then they're like, look, that's a little bit close, we would like you to take that out, this and, or not like you, you're taking it out. And so there's a little bit of to in and fro in, and you know, I knew that they would, they want, you know, I thought, do you know what? What I'm going to do is just write it as it is.
Yeah.
And then give it to them. They're like, ah, no, take that out. You can't. That. And then we'd sort of like eventually come up with, so it actually, it's worked out really well.
Oh, it is, yeah. And what about the brotherhood, as you call them, or your fellow?
They're all right.
What do they think about it all?
They're okay. I mean, the book, we'll find out because it's come out today, so we'll see.
Yeah,
a little bit anxious about that. See what they say about that. But everything else, you know, the TV stuff, they're pretty, they're quite happy with it.
Yeah,
there's nothing really that we've. I would never do anything that would jeopardise people that are still doing that job. I wouldn't talk about things that the Ministry of Defence would get jittery about. So I'm okay, and they're all happy with it as well. I've got mates that are still in, and they're like, oh, you know, they give me a little bit of shit, but. But good.
Aren't they writing to you going, when I get out, can you get me a gig on TV?
It's funny that, yeah. Yeah, they all come out of the woodwork.
How did you get your gig on TV then?
Right, so I left. I did this job that I hated.
Mm-hmm.
Realised it was going to kill me doing that. Left that. Went into security.
By the way, it's worth reading the book just for him taking this job on, and then you can look at your own jobs. I look at TV and go, Jesus Christ, I'm surrounded by those people. Yeah, go on.
But, yeah. I did. So I then went into security, which I didn't want to do. I wanted to stay away from the whole bodyguarding thing. Not that it's a bad job. I just didn't want... It's hard work.
Yeah.
And I got a contract with an oil exec just as the price of oil crashed, so that contract fell down. I was skint, jobless. A friend of mine phoned me up and said, mate, I've got some work, can you do it? I said yes. It was basically me looking after, I was basically an underwater cameraman's dive buddy, and we were filming underwater archaeologists diving on shipwrecks looking for pirate treasure. They didn't find pirate treasure, they found loads of teacups. I found a big bar of silver that belonged to Captain Kidd.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It was all right, yeah. Yeah. And then obviously from the back end of that...
By the way, he tells that story in the book, but it's a lot more in-depth. It's good, yeah.
Yeah, but off the back end of that, you know, this idea had come about with the Channel 4, and they said, great, but where do you find these XSF guys? And this bloke was like, well, maybe you should phone this dude up. So I got a phone call when I landed, wondering what my next job would be, and they said, essentially, they were like, do you want to be on TV? I was like, yeah. It wasn't like that. I thought it was a consultancy role, and then it turned into more of a... It was consultancy and then on screen.
Do you enjoy it, the TV
stuff?
Yeah,
I love it.
What's it like being famous as someone who's...
I wouldn't have said on that. Do you know, most
you
of the time...
You do get recognised, though, right?
Well, yeah. Some people are like, come that. On. Did we go to school? I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, well, I get that still. Yeah, on the tube. It's so embarrassing. It's
like,
yeah,
I know, yeah. So, yeah, no, it's part of it, isn't it? I suppose you just got to roll with it. But the TV, the media world, TV, is so... The people fundamentally are so much like SF guys.
Are they?
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's not... I mean, both sides are going to hate me for that, because obviously we're seen as like a bunch of right-wing bloody lunatics, and we, you know, the military see TV as a bit,
yeah,
sort of like, you know, bit snowflakey.
Yeah.
But it's not, by the way. But but no, fundamentally, I mean, you know, we all like to... We like to be mega busy. We like to be perfectionist, so to speak. You want to do everything to the best of your ability, deliver decent stuff. You like a million different things going on at the same time. You like to keep your mind busy. You like to travel. And then when you get a chance to let your hair down, you let your hair down properly. So fundamentally, they're almost identical. It's just beliefs, opinions. And
was it a nice thing that when you did the show, suddenly you realised how much people love the... I mean, I'm sure you know how much people love the Special Forces, but even more so after you're doing the show.
I didn't realise, to be honest. I didn't...
Do the people in Special Forces not know that?
Nah, it's because it's so... There's no... No one knows anything about it, really. And, you know, part of me, when I got offered it, I was like, well, if I don't do it, someone else is going to do it. They'll get someone else. That was part of my argument when I spoke to the Ministry of Defence. And then I didn't really know how it was going to go down. I remember we did the shoot and we were like, I don't really know. One of the directors was like, this is going to be massive. And we're like, yeah, whatever. We were like, I'm sure it will be. And then, it was like, whoa, what the?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get a lot of good feedback and there's like not a lot of bad press. There's a little bit, but it's been all right. It's been mental in a good way.
Yeah. Were you regarded as a top soldier? Is that how they regard you in the military?
Well, I suppose.
And then do they keep that thought when you leave, or do you just is there any contact? Do they keep in contact with you? Is it like your family forever?
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's a contact that's in, you know, in the headquarters that I have to talk to, and I have to keep him abreast of a few, you know, I spoke to him about this book. That was a headache of his for a bit. SAS, Who Dares Wins, every time that comes about, we've got to, you know, I have to write a request to be involved in that and promise that I'm not going to talk about any secrets and what have you. And then he gets to see little bits of it, or that department do. So I'm always talking to them, but then, you know, when I first left, because of those reasons and mental health reasons, I totally cut it away. I disappeared off the face of the planet as far as they were concerned, which is another reason, which is another thing that affected me even more. And now I'm actually, you know, I'm closely in touch with guys that are still in all the time.
Do you think they should do more of that then, keep people in contact with each other? They are trying harder, I suppose, aren't they, at the moment?
They are trying a lot harder. They're getting a lot better. But it is about contact. It is about keeping in touch and just keeping an eye out for each other, do you know?
I suppose we've been in conflict now for a long enough time that there's a lot of guys out there with PTSD.
Yeah, and also because it's slowed down a little bit now, you know, we're not as heavily involved in these areas anymore. So when you're in it, it's you're just in it. It's when it slows down for me, it's when it will stop that's really, you know, okay, I felt that dark cloud and all that, but when it actually stopped, that's when it really went mad.
Yeah, because you do mention the word in there, it defined me, which is what I've talked about quite a lot in this podcast with sport and stuff like that, when the footballers retire and all that. It's also, not only do they lose all the camaraderie and all that stuff, they were something, a footballer. You were, you know.
There's a lot of kudos, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, and suddenly you lose that, and who are you then?
I started up an organisation with a mate of mine, Jamie, who's actually mentioned, he's got a little piece in there actually.
In the book, yeah.
Yeah, and we sort of predominantly deal with veterans and their dependents, you know, their families, but we have also dealt with, like, pro sports people, people from the emergency services, you know, all these people, you know, that have quite long careers that are, you know, there's a kudos that goes with those careers, and then when it finishes, they're like, who am I?
Mm.
Where do I get that changing room banter again? Where do I get that feeling of either running onto a pitch or being someone, being a useful individual?
And when you did the program, Meet the Drug Lords inside the Real Narcos, what was it like doing stuff like that, moving into sort of that side of the TV industry?
I loved it.
Did you?
Yeah, I really loved it. I'm hopefully going to be doing more. We're looking at stuff now, but that's probably what I really love the most.
Why?
I don't know. It's like going away, meeting people, getting to understand people that I wouldn't normally meet. Sometimes people I would have been fighting against, but it's just, again, I find it's quite enlightening to go and see those places. It's adrenaline, bit of adrenaline.
But do you ever think, though, that, are you ever in the situation where you're looking at this going, this is just ridiculous that we've made all this stuff so illegal that this lot are doing... Or again, can you not get involved in the politics? I'm not talking about the documentary. I'm talking about when you're actually doing it in the army and special forces.
Again, when you're doing it, you don't. It's a job. Yeah. That is it. It is a job. It is that clean cut. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. It's a job. it's only now when you've been out and done that documentary and looked at it, you're like, is there a better way of doing this? Maybe we're fighting this war on the wrong level. Maybe we should fight it socially, you know, with education, infrastructure, investment in faraway places with forgotten people. There's a lot more to it than just tooling up an army and sending them in.
I had Peter Blexley on here, who's policeman copper who was playing clothes for years and does the program Hunted now on
the
such a great guy. But he said on here, I spent all these years trying to catch the drug dealers and infiltrate them and do that, and he goes, and I just think it's a waste of time, we shouldn't be doing it. It's like, and he said I spent all my life doing that, by the way. Listen to that podcast because he's brilliant. Hopefully he's going to come back soon as well, which I'm looking forward to. So talking about that though, when you're just trying to you're just doing what the orders tell you to do and all that sort of stuff, I don't want to get all sort of Alan Partridge here. You know, what's it like to kill a man, sort of thing? But it was like you do discuss on it a few bits where, because you do cover it, which is amazing. It's like I wondered whether you would go through talking about it, how you sort of managed to detach yourself from that actual stuff which is going on when you look at dead bodies and when you see dead bodies and you don't know whether you've hit them and you don't. Was it a tough thing to put in a book?
Nah. I don't think it was. I think it needed to be in there because it is essentially, that's one of the things that can affect people. I know morally I always acted in the right way when it came to stuff like that, and I don't think it was a case of, we go into this whole them and us thing, but it is literally that. It's a job that you do. It's an unfortunate byproduct of a job that I loved. It's weird that I have a job that I love with something that's quite pretty gritty, really.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that I loved that at all, and far from it, but it wasn't something that I was going to dwell on too much because I knew that the decisions I'd made were right. What did affect me was the sort of psychological impact you have on everyday people that are just unfortunately mingling around in that area that you're fighting in. And you see, I think I spoke about the deadpan expression on a child's face. They're that shocked that there's no noise, nothing. They're just like, and I remember, not at the time, I didn't really take it in, but it was a bit later where I was like, that's quite hard. There's someone there they're an innocent young child. I wouldn't want my kids to see that.
Yeah, the sort of way you described it, which I thought was quite good, is when you were looking at the dead bodies, or you were saying you're a bit detached from it, like it was a TV or a movie.
Yeah.
Because that's how you have to go through, I suppose.
I think it is just a natural coping mechanism.
Yeah. And then you talked about children with your kryptonite, and I suppose that's when reality hits you, when you see a child. That is it.
I reckon a lot of it's to do with age. Like, that job is a young man's game, and obviously as we get older and we have families and we're aware of our mortality, then you start overthinking stuff, and that's why you get PTSD and stuff like that. And there was things that happened in my life that made me think about what it was we were involved in. I had a kid, she wasn't very well, that sort of thing made me more emotional.
And do you think that there's a humour involved in, there must be for you guys?
Oh, it's horrendous. it's brutal, honestly.
I just imagine it is, yeah, because to survive that.
Some guys, before we'd go out on it, this is dark, by the way, but some guys before you go out were like getting ready, kitting up and waiting to travel out to the helicopter and get on it and, think about what it is that we're going to be doing that night. You'd be guys like going, little did Foxy know that this was the last time he was going to crap into porcelain. I'm like, mate,
oh, God, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But it's their way of doing that, their dark humour. I never entered into it because I was always like, oh, that's not funny, man.
Man.
So there's some weird humour going on,
Yeah, that must be, A, must be hard, but B, no, not hard, but you must miss that sort of stuff then when you...
I mean, I'll meet up with the lads and I'm like, remember when you used to joke about that? And they're like, yeah, that was pretty harsh, wasn't it? I'm like, mate, that was,
How many times did you actually have to go out on missions, do you think, was it like just weekly you were going out all the time?
You'd be away, so a lot of the tours are like 6 months. I did a 9 month once. But 6 months, and on average, probably you'd be going out maybe when it was at its height, like almost every other night. Otherwise, averaging is like 3 or 4 times a week, which you know you didn't really know what you were going into. Sometimes you'd get into a scrap, sometimes it would be absolute sheer boredom, which is the emotional roller coaster being away.
And what about sleep deprivation? Because it's hard to sleep, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's the military had you'd pride yourself on not and being able to operate on hardly any sleep. It used to be this macho thing. Well, I've only had 2 hours sleep. I'm all over it. And actually, when you step away from it, and you look at what sleep deprivation does to you, you know, 24 hours without sleep, and you're the equivalent of like something like 5 times over the limit drink driving because of, you know, your mind's just not firing on all cylinders. So, and then add to that that you're carrying around a weapon and expected to make split second decisions. It's bizarre. Like when I'd go away on tour and I would probably sleep 4 hours in 24, something like that.
Wow.
And get up and train, and you know, we used to get sent out super strong coffee.
But you voluntarily got up in early in the morning to train, didn't you?
Yeah. There was like 3 or 4 of us that were like into it.
Did you used to hang out with the American forces as well?
Yeah, we did a lot of work with the Yanks. Yeah, good
guys.
Yeah,
you're all friends when you're out there.
Yeah, really good. They're good. They put a lot of time and effort into being out there, and they're very much of the they're good at what they do. They got a lot of cash, that's why we're their friends.
Do they have better rations than us?
They got better rations. They'd have like a fridge full of Coca-Cola, their Ben and Jerry's on tap, so we'd always go over to the Americans. And
really,
like if you're on the main base, every Thursday was surf and turf, steak and lobster.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
What do they think of us?
Miserable.
Us, look at me putting myself in your cap.
They just, you know, miserable bastards. Always whinging, but actually get the job done.
Right.
There's mutual respect there. We have a good laugh with them, actually.
Yeah. Is it my mate, who's the one I was talking about earlier, is the Marine. I went for a walk with him just to around the. I can't remember where we went now, Peak Districts or something.
Yeah, yeah.
The amount of preparation we had to do for that was unbelievable.
Yeah.
He went, no. He had a checklist with him, and he went through it, and he went through all my kit bag, make sure we're staying in a cave for a night. He goes, we're not going to go up there and get caught in the wet. We are prepping because, you know, I'm not carrying you down.
Yeah,
that's it. And he went, you learn this stuff, Tim. You've got to prepare, and then nothing. Is that how you still go through life?
Yeah, a little bit. I think we're the sort of, when we do that show, like the production company, and we're like, all right, you need to have this done, and when it's not done, we're like, we lose our shit. And
yeah,
I think they have a love hate relationship with us, but yeah, it's all about preparation. Prior preparation prevents piss poor performance.
Yeah. Do you like it when the public come on your show and they're crap and they've got like the big ego, and then it's
awesome. So much fun. We've just done the Stand Up to Cancer one as well, so yeah, that was even better because it was celebs.
How much? Oh, which ones? Can you tell or not?
Can't say anything.
Okay,
yet,
no. All right. How much of it is mental and how much is physical then? When you're pushing yourself through on that,
you don't need to be that fit. That's a load of crap. You've got to be physically robust. That doesn't mean you're super strong or anything. You've just, you know, if you go over on your ankle, you don't bust it, you know, that sort of thing. But it's all to do with your head. You know, I turned up 350 people. I'm 25 years old. There's a few guys older than me, a few guys younger than me. Some guys are like massive, ripped up, and you're like, they're going, you're doubting yourself, going, have I prepared? And actually, I hadn't prepared because it was just after Christmas, so I'd
been drinking.
I was carrying a bit of timber. But, you know, once after about 3 weeks, they're not there, they've gone. All these like superhuman individuals will think they're gone because they didn't really want to be there. They were doing it because of it was a status thing as opposed to actually wanting to do that job.
Do you still have thoughts about being in conflict and stuff?
Cropping up into my mind?
Yeah, does it come back?
I think about it every now and again. Yeah, it depends what I'm doing. It depends if anything's reminded me.
But it's okay now?
Yeah. It is like, you know, I think about it and yeah, that was that. It's just a building block to where I am now.
And you loving your life, the rowing challenge as well.
I didn't love that.
Some quite gruesome bits in that, especially to do with your bottom. But
my mate, I was literally.
Go on, tell us the story. Go on.
One with my backside, and I'm like, you're gonna have to have a look at it. And he's
like, there, like, where are you rowing? First of all, tell everyone where you're rowing. Right.
So we rowed from Portugal, Lagos in Portugal, and we rode to Venezuela. So
why?
I got drunk, and that's how I got involved. did it for charity.
Yeah.
It was actually something that did save me mentally, I think.
Yeah.
But it was long.
Yeah, go on.
50 days. We were the first people to row from mainland Europe to mainland South America.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the Guinness Book of Records, apparently. Well, it is. I've seen it.
You've done quite a lot. You've done that. You've discovered Captain
Kid's
treasure. Yeah, you've done quite a bit in your time. Wow. Go on. So your bum's hurting you.
Oh, the bum thing. Yeah. So obviously, there I am, laid on my side, pulling my arse cheeks apart, and my mate Aldo is like, "Oh, mate, really?" He goes, "You got a boil," and it was right next to my hoop. And so literally, so the next week, he had to like administer my first aid to this. Like Lancet every morning, and I'm there, losing my dignity. But I'd rather lose my dignity than have to lance my own boil.
Yeah. I suppose when you're out on your missions and stuff, I suppose there's not a lot of, you can't be shy, can you? When you're with all your mates.
That's the point that we've made on the last sort of SAS thing we did, was, you know, the mixed. We've done a mixed one, men, male and female, and it was about it. It wasn't about the toughness of the job, you know, the physicality of it. It's about the uncomfortableness. You know, I've been in an observation post, living in a hole with four guys, and I take a shit in a bit of cling film next to me mate, wrap it up, put it in the top of my backpack. You've got to get over that stuff. It's those uncomfortable moments that are the hardest, the unglamorous bits that are the hardest part of the job.
Wow.
Mm.
Talking about that, you're doing mixed. It was announced this week that women are now going to be accepted into the special forces. I imagine. How do we go around this? I imagine the problem with it is that I'm reading your book. It's so wonderful because you talk about the mental side of everything, adding that into the mix. I don't want to stitch you up here, if you don't want to answer it, that's fine.
No.
Adding women into the mix might be quite hard when at the moment it's a very male dominated. There's 30 guys. We're going out. We're on missions. How do you see it?
The argument that people keep coming up with is women can do the job, and I'm like, of course they can. There is going to be millions of women that are strong enough, hard enough, physically and mentally. It's not about that. It's whether men and women can do that job together. You know, the dynamic that spins. And I haven't got the answers. I can't say whether they will or they won't. But it will cause a lot. There will be issues arise from it. And if men and women working together affects a unit's operational output, then I would suggest no, they shouldn't.
I imagine they can, but in the future. If you just throw it all together now, I think it could be quite complicated. But I think
it will do. We've got, the society has to change. It's, you know, it's got a long way to go before we're comfortable with that.
But we all were uncomfortable when women first started joining the army, weren't we? And now it's fine. You know, everyone understands it. Yeah,
so you've got to iron it out. It's got to be done, and then see how it goes. Test and adjust.
And I suppose, as we mentioned earlier, war's changing because of the drones, because of the cyber, because the boots on the ground and stuff. Mm. So I suppose there's different dynamics happening.
I bet it's funny because there's obviously a lot of women that are like, you know, this needs to change. And I bet the women that are married to the guys that are in at the moment aren't too keen for it to change.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So there's that as well.
About that side of things, yeah.
Yeah, because you do mention that, as I mentioned earlier on in the podcast about that, relationships. You're still a human.
Yeah.
When you're out there and you're doing your job, you're still a human. You can't switch it off.
No.
Yeah, because obviously you talk about your child in there and stuff and how you want to be back at home.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly. You do all this super special force stuff, and you're like, I was still born a kid.
Yeah.
I still have the same thoughts as everyone else.
Yeah.
Feelings, whatever.
Listen, I ask everyone who comes on this podcast the same questions. So if you don't mind, I'll run through these with you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Be honest with yourself. If you're going to lie to someone, don't lie to yourself, because you know you're lying and it will do your head in.
And maybe you've taken that one step further by being honest with everyone.
Yeah.
Is there an element of feeling a bit more free because you've said, done? Oh, you don't know the response of this book yet, but no, I mean, basically, because you put it all in there, does it feel freeing?
Yeah, it's good that it's out there. I hope people will get something from it. Hopefully that bit of advice will come sing through in that, maybe.
What's the biggest mistake you've made?
Never made mistakes.
Have you been on a mission going, oh no, what? Oh,
let's have a think about that. There's a funny story. I don't know whether I wrote in that because it is mega embarrassing. As a soldier, it's mega embarrassing. And, you know, I just finished selection. I've joined a squadron, you know, and that's a big come down as well. You finish selection. There's 10 of you left after 350 people. And you're like, I am the dog's obvious. And then you join a squadron and there's all these proper battle-hardened lads that are like, shut the fuck. And you're like, oh. Anyway, it was one of the first things. It was a training job. We're all in our, you know, that black kit that looks quite menacing, all balaclavaed up. We're in a room that's a really small room, but it's got like about 40 guys in there, crammed in there. I've got a shotgun. I'm down on one knee and that blokes are waiting to go. We're waiting to do a training serial. And I'm like reloading the shotgun and I'm like, hold, which means wait. And everyone's like, hurry up. And then I'm trying to rack the shotgun and it jams. I don't know what's wrong with it. And I can't quite see what's going on. And I'm like, hang on a minute. And then the bloke that's running the range comes over and he's like, let me have a look. So no one can tell who anyone is, gets his torch out. And he's like, oh, it would help if you put the bullets in the right way round. And I still to this day think he was lying. But literally everyone was like, ooh, I could hear people screaming and shouting, going, who is it? And he's like, who is it? And I was just like, oh no. And I was like, it's Foxy. And they were like, ooh. And obviously one of my mates that had just joined the squadron with I could hear him howling. And I knew, and he even said after, he goes, I'm so glad that wasn't me. So not a mega embarrassing moment, but it was at the time. It was horrific.
Brilliant. Any life hacks? You must have a good hack for us to go through our lives with.
A life hack? I mean,
something about like travel tips or, you know.
Everything about life for me is I just want to have a good time, fun. I'm not fussed about anything else other than just having a laugh.
I suppose you've got seen death. So
you still have a laugh out there doing that stuff.
You've seen it, so you know how important life is.
Yeah,
whereas the rest of us are so immune from it, we don't see it at all. So
it's more, no matter what I'm doing, whether it's travel, anything, all I want to do is have a laugh.
Apart from your own, is there a book you recommend?
I'm quite into boring. People would find them not that. I'm quite into factual books, really.
So am I. Are you allowed to take books when you go out?
I don't read that much fiction. I'll read a little bit. Read a bit of Lee Child. I quite like Jack Reacher. but I do. There's a book called Chasing the Scream that I'm sort of nearly done at the moment. That's about the history of the war on drugs.
Oh.
Fascinating.
Okay.
Really, really, really interesting. Dark. I'm into that history side of things. There's another really, really good book called Ghost Wars, which is about Afghanistan, the rise and fall of, you know, AQ and all that sort of thing. But they're the
What's
sort
AQ?
Of Al-Qaeda.
All right.
You know, the start of Bin Laden and that relationship with Afghanistan and the Middle East and America and Pakistan. It's quite fascinating into that.
What did you do for entertainment when you were out there?
When I'm out? Oh, out there. Yeah. Just absolutely hammer each other. There's an awful lot. I mean, there's a bit in there when we talk about the box of doom, where someone had made a mistake and we made him pay for it. There was a lot of, that stuff like that, more bantery sort of.
But do you get
a bit of TV.
Is there TV?
Yeah.
And what's it, American
it was towards
TV?
The end.
American
we've got Sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watched a lot of football. Love the football, yeah.
Any, who do you support?
Arsenal.
Any
doing all right at the moment.
Card scores or anything? He'd had to
darts. Did a lot of darts. Played darts. I'm rubbish at darts. did a lot of, you sort of become the dice men. We have like these two big dice. You're not allowed to call them dice when you're in. They're called mice. It's a rule. If you call dice, you're in trouble.
Right.
And you used to roll. And any decision that needed making, you'd roll the dice.
Really?
Yeah, it was awesome, yeah. Like literally, you know, forfeits, punishments, the dice get rolled.
Oh, that's kind of...
Yeah, making... Everything down from making comes coffee.
I mean, it's not the same, but I worked in a restaurant years ago and every decision by the staff there was done on dice because the dice man had come out and we were all reading the book, you know.
It's
quite addictive, isn't it, that book? when you watch TV and movies, the war movies, what do you make of them?
Some of them are good, yeah. I really like... So modern day type ones... Zero Dark Thirty is pretty awesome.
I don't know that one.
It's the last 45 minutes of the SEAL team guys that went in and got Bin Laden. And Catherine Bigelow is the director, and she has nailed. I mean, there's a couple of inaccuracies, but she's nailed the atmosphere. If you want to know what it's like to be on the ground as an SF soldier, watch that film.
Really?
Yeah, good. I'm like, I always like. Gets me going when I watch it, as in like just
gets you going. You want to be there, or gets you going that you don't want to be there.
You're in that moment. I don't know how she does it, but she's done a very good job. Good advisors, really? But she's captured the really.
What,
good.
What about the big Hollywood ones? Because you mentioned Rambo in your book. What about that?
Love like Rambo. That I mean, he's a legend. Nothing is over.
All right, final question. What's the meaning of life?
Again, just have a laugh.
Just have a laugh.
Just have a laugh. Yeah, yeah. Life's. I hate it when there's too much seriousness going on. Life's too short to take it too seriously.
Have you always been like that, or do you think it's because?
I think it sort of went against me for a little bit when you're trying to establish yourself in a military career. But
yeah,
you know, I think that was another reason I went on selection and to join the special forces was you can be yourself pretty much.
Yeah. Would you recommend people go in and join?
I would do, yeah, if it's the right thing. It was the right thing for me, you know. I needed that. I wasn't an outgoing person. I was quite quiet, quite easily led. Couldn't look after myself. Didn't know my arse from my elbow. So I needed that, and it worked for me.
I've got to say, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. I recommend anyone listening to this to go and read it. You talk about a director, whoever that was just a minute ago, because I can't remember who
Catherine
you said it was.
Bigelow,
yeah, that was
yeah.
it. How she captured it. Reading this book, it makes me anxious, but you also really explain what it's like to actually be in war zones, and so it's a really good job. Well done, Jason.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming on today.
No, I appreciate it.
If anyone wants to follow you, you're on Twitter, but you've got a weird name, haven't you? Jason_Carl_Fox. Right.
Yeah.
Anywhere else they can follow you, or is that what you're doing at
Twitter?
Twitter,
Insta.
Any Instagram as well.
Insta's the same, yeah.
Okay. Thanks so much, mate.
Mate, thanks a lot. Awesome.
Top man. Cheers.
Cheers.
That was Jason Fox. What a lovely bloke.
Yes.
Really nice when you meet someone like him and he just turns out to be a really nice bloke.
Yeah.
Do you think you'd be good doing...
No. I'd be awful.
Really?
You look at me.
I'm not sure I could.
You'd be equally as bad.
Yeah, you like to think, don't you? I'd like to think like I'm a, you know, I could get out there and do it. Or I just don't think I could handle it mentally. I'm not strong enough.
I'd be doing it thinking, I could be lying in bed watching Netflix.
I could be lying up watching the same sort of stuff on Netflix.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm gonna watch that film. Now
Zero Dark Thirty, it was huge. Oscars and
do you
all
know
sorts?
I it's passed me by.
It's great. Yeah,
I suppose it was because I just want another one of those films where I just thought it's another one of those war film type things.
Yeah,
and so I haven't watched it, but maybe I should watch
we
it.
We were talking about Rambo afterwards, weren't we? With Jason,
he talks about Rambo in his book.
Does he? Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he does. So that's
it's
why
really
I mentioned it. Before everyone thinks I'm really stupid, Rambo is mentioned in his book. He talks about it. And then we've just had a conversation with him since he left the podcast. He goes, I loved Rambo.
I do. Have you watched it recently, First Blood?
No.
Check it out.
No, I only watch films once.
But it's not about what you think it's about. It's about,
PTSD,
looks like it's PTSD,
yeah.
and sort of not given, the vets were given, when they come out of Vietnam, were given no help or guidance or anything. They were just left. It's a great film. It's one of my favourites.
Oh, it was just an amazing film, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When it came out, it was just phenomenal. What an impact.
it's a little bit before my, was it 85, 86? I was...
Oh yeah, I
was quite young.
I couldn't do that either. No, I went up to the cinema to watch it.
Did you?
Yeah, I remember the cinema I went to. It was in Windmill Street. It's now a really cool cinema. It wasn't back then. Do you remember that? Do you know that? Sorry for anyone who doesn't live in London, but it's Windmill Street up in the West End of London.
What, the CD?
It used to be
CD.
Yeah, it used to be quite CD.
Is it nice now?
Oh, it's really good. Oh, okay. It's one of those ones with sort of, you know, all the food you can eat in there and stuff.
Kermode's nightmare.
Is it?
Well, no, it would be. If it's got like food,
oh, no,
they serve
food.
You food.
No, they don't serve you food in there, but you can buy food beforehand and stuff. It's really, yeah, it's really nice. But I went up and I remember because I was dressed as a casual. There you go. I put a chini tracksuit top on. I remember it all very vividly.
Yeah, watch Zero Dark Thirty. It's very good.
Okay, I will do. All right, that's it for this week's podcast.
If I remember correctly,
go on.
John Barrowman's in it, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's the one he's in. Right. There's one where you're watching a war film and you go, is that John Barrowman from Torchwood?
Torchwood. I thought you might go with the children's. He's lovely, John Barrowman.
Yes, he is.
Such a good laugh to have on the TV show. He's so funny. All right, that's it for this week's podcast. Do you know what? The book is Jason Fox. The book is called Battle Scars, The Story of War and All That Follows. If you're interested in that sort of stuff, or you're just interested in the mindset of someone who's out there, I really thoroughly recommend that. He's put it all... not left anything here. He's put it all on the pages, and I think it'd be fascinating to know the reaction to it. I actually didn't know we'd booked him on the day of the launch, if I'm already honest with you.
Wow.
So I thought it had been out a week or so, but so it'd be great to see the reaction. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Definitely recommend you reading it. Drop us an email if you want to say anything. dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy. Keep your problems coming in as well. We'll be doing another mailbag very shortly. For the time being, peace and love, Joy. Bye.
Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.